This is Scott Allen from odecode.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Coon from lazycoder.com.
Hi, this is John with a quick announcement. Scott Lazycoder Coon is going to be ditching out on us for a little while on account of woman trouble. As in, he's got himself a brand new daughter to deal with. So join us in congratulating Scott and his growing family, and hang in there with us until Scott gets his priorities straightened out and rejoins us on the show.
Welcome to the end of the year episode of Herding Code. In this episode, we're going to take a look back at some of the things that happened during 2008 and also take a look forward into 2009. So I thought one topic we might want to touch on is, what's the coolest new geek thing of 2008? Was it Google releasing a new browser? Was it Firefox 3? Was it the second release of the iPhone? Was it the video streaming over Hulu.com? Personally, I don't own an iPhone as yet still. I thought Google Chrome was pretty interesting, if only because the whole idea of JavaScript actually being a JITted language and being performant is going to change a lot of things coming up in the future. Really changes how people perceive JavaScript these days, I think.
Yeah, I guess I'd have to agree. I mean, I think like Firefox 3 is really cool, but it's kind of expected, and I guess that's kind of one of the downsides of publishing your roadmap, is that, you know, anyone that wanted to see it has been running Firefox 3 for a while or whatever, and Chrome just kind of came out of nowhere, and I mean, the killer feature for me is that task manager. I just love it when I run way too many tabs and all of a sudden my computer slows down. I can look in the task manager and say, okay, this tab's running slow, or Flash or Silverlight is hung up, and then just kill it. And the browser doesn't die, and I can reload the tab and it'll restart. It's, I don't know. It's kind of gone to being my main browser right now. So,
Kevin, you just got an iPhone, didn't you?
I did, actually. That was Santa brought me an iPhone this year. I was very, very happy.
Didn't you break it in like one day?
I didn't break it. It broke itself. There's an important difference there. It was actually 3 days. And yes, well, my first phone died, which was quite frustrating and meant I had to go to an Apple store on Christmas Eve, which is really, really not where you want to be. But got a new phone.
They took care of you?
They did take care of me, yeah. Gave me a new phone. So, you know, that issue aside, I think the iPhone is just a killer device. I mean, I have not been smartphone enabled prior to this. So to a certain extent, the cool factor is just having, you know, the internet everywhere I go. But beyond that, just the user experience on it is just so awesome that, you know, it's just the kind of thing that makes you happy to use. And those things are rare in the computer industry. So I've definitely been very pleased. I do agree about Chrome. You know, it's a very cool thing. If only because it's, you know, increases competition in the browser space, and competition is only good for consumers. I mean, once again, we've got, you know, the browser wars on, and it's driving tons and tons of innovation in the browser space. So that's just been totally exciting. And it's nice to see WebKit have a real solid, you know, Windows implementation. You know, Safari for Windows kind of doesn't cut it as a real, you know, browser that I would ever use. So now we've got, you know, a good WebKit-based browser that we can run on Windows, and you know, it's fast and it's got some really cool features, and yeah, I dig it. But it is not enough to take me away from Firefox as my primary browser. I will say that. I'm still too extension addicted to cut over to Chrome. But if they do ever get their extension system robust and you know, to develop the kind of community that Firefox has, then I will definitely be tempted.
You were talking about all sorts of new plugins for Firefox today.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I'm not the kind of guy who actually normally runs like 50 extensions like some crazy people. But recently, there's been this like total spate of new extensions that I've found that have been just really cool. One that I found today was I'm blanking on the name. I can look it up, but Site Launcher is the name. Thank you, John. It's basically a keyboard launcher for websites, so you can assign keyboard hotkeys to websites and bring them up really easily. Another one I found recently lets you assign download folders to particular domain names. So for me personally, I use that because I do a lot of electronic billing and electronic banking, and so I download all my Bank of America stuff into a particular folder, and I download all my, you know, blah, blah, blah. So though that, you know, that just sort of like enhances my productivity of my workflow while I'm doing that stuff. Anyway, so that's the kind of stuff that, like, these little like productivity tweaks that I get out of Firefox really just still make it the killer platform for me. And I'm not willing to give that up yet.
Cool. Any other things stand out?
Well, you mentioned Hulu, and I mean, it's not the incredible geekiest thing, but it just really is one of those, it just works kind of things where, I mean, we use it all the time. My wife is a huge fan. You know, I mean, it's a huge wife acceptance factor thing. I mean, it's just, it really has kind of, I don't know, it's shown a viable way of distributing video over the web, you know, and the commercials are short enough and the content generally good enough that it's worth watching, you know? So, I mean,
well, that's why I'm surprised it doesn't generate more buzz. The quality is definitely higher than YouTube. And you get the instant satisfaction as opposed to BitTorrent, where you leave it run for a while before you can watch the video. But I've seen it come up in a few conversations this year. I was kind of surprised, and I went around poking today, and I saw that it was actually put together by NBC and another company. I'm just surprised someone like Microsoft or Google or Yahoo didn't put this together earlier. But I guess it really had to be backed by a media company first.
Hulu seemed to kind of come out of nowhere. You know, Juiced was getting all the buzz in the last year, and it seemed like Hulu kind of crept up and has taken over that space. And I agree, it's very cool. I mean, I don't really use it on a daily basis. Most of my use of it has been when our DVR like fails to record the last 2 minutes of the show, and like, oh, we gotta go look up what happened. So we jump over to Hulu and watch the end. But I could definitely see it becoming like a primary way to watch television. Maybe not next year, but in a couple years. My problem is I still use a television and I don't have a computer hooked up to it. I mean, normally anyway, I can hook one up when I need to. So until that becomes, you know, a really common thing, and it's just, you know, a lot of geeks, it is a common thing, but for a lot of other people, it isn't. Then I think it's going to be sort of a geek favorite, but not really breakthrough in the mainstream.
Internet Explorer 8 has been better than I would have expected. It's not awesome. It doesn't really stack up to what the other browsers are doing, but it's a solid step forward. And I'm impressed with some of the decisions they've made as far as compatibility. So I like where it's going, that IE8 may not be the greatest browser, but it's not going to be holding us back quite so much as previous browsers. And it's taking steps forward in a way that hopefully makes it hard to defend staying on IE6.
Yeah, getting off IE6 would be good. I mean, what do you think it would take for IE to become, to move up to the next tier? Would they need to make it easier to write plugins and extensions for Internet Explorer? It seems that, you know, Firefox has all these wonderful extensions, and people are just inspired to write these things for Firefox, whereas with IE, you know, maybe it's because it's from Microsoft, it just doesn't inspire anyone to sit down and write something to enhance productivity.
Well, I mean, some people do, and, you know, there are some great IE extensions like IE 7 Pro, but it's just so friggin' painful to do. You know, you're stuck back in calm hell. And it's just not something that most people are going to, you know, sort of cobble together really quickly. So yeah, I think a you know, extension framework would be great, but I don't know. From a sort of power geek perspective, I don't see IE cutting it anytime in the next few years. They don't seem to be focused on the right things. They're not, you know, they're going to release IE8 and they're going to be hugely behind the ball in terms of you know, performance and JavaScript and rendering speed. So I'm not optimistic for IE8, you know, as anything but the, you know, the Yugo of web browsers.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that they have done that's a minor step forward is they've got these accelerators and web slices and, you know, ways of doing extensions in which you're just writing XML and linking out to a web service or something. So that is kind of a hack around it. But I agree. I mean, they really should have some sort of way that you know, zip up some C# or, you know, something. And I mean, the way that you do extensions everywhere else is you write some like Zool is just so simple. It's very, you know, HTML, CSS, JavaScript like, and it's a zip file and it's just brain dead simple. And I think until IE does that, they're really going to be, like you said, the Yugo. But at least if the Yugo's, you know, not holding us back too much, it's, I think that there's a lot of stuff too that in order for IE to really be leading the curve, there's a lot of hidden features that all the other browsers support and IE doesn't. And I don't know, it would take a lot to really impress. They would have to make a lot of progress to impress the people that really get into browser features.
All right, moving on to the next topic. I was thinking today about what was the most exciting development this year for people in the .NET space. Was it ASP.NET MVC, which isn't completely released yet, but it's pretty close. A lot of people have been developing with the betas. Or was it the Silverlight 2 release? Was it jQuery officially becoming embraced by Microsoft and putting into ASP.NET? I thought that was pretty exciting from just the perspective of here's an open source product that Microsoft is putting into their product and actually providing support for.
Not from a product perspective, but from a sort of philosophy perspective, the inclusion of open source in a Microsoft product is like a humongous leap. And I'm not even talking about the support part of it. Just embedding open source in their product has been a gigantic bugaboo for them. Like, they have not been willing to go that way. So for them to finally pull the trigger on that is like a major just mind shift for them. And that's the piece of it that is just kind of blew me away and was really unexpected as far as I'm concerned. Certainly from a product perspective, MVC was one of the most exciting things I saw last year and just continues to be the way that I want to build web applications. Like, I don't ever want to go back to WebForms.
Yeah, I guess I'd have to agree. I think MVC seems to be the biggest kind of step forward in terms of, you know, it's going to affect the most people, and it's a positive step forward in development. I think that Silverlight is a, you know, a huge technological step. I think that, you know, running, I think that getting a workable subset of .NET and XAML rendering into 4 megabytes is huge, and it's not just about the browser anymore, as you're seeing in Mesh and other places where they're leveraging that tiny .NET core. So I mean, I'm excited about Silverlight 2, and I think that Silverlight 2 is a huge step over Silverlight 1, but in the huge scheme of software development, I can't really say it's, you know, the hugest, most exciting thing for .NET developers this past year.
So just to throw a couple other hats into the ring here, I mean, a couple of other big things that were announced this year were at PDC were Oslo and Azure. What do you guys think on those fronts? I mean, are those exciting to you? Do you think they have some major potential? Obviously, they're not, you know, released product yet, but did those kind of, you know, float your boat this year?
I think Azure has some potential. I definitely see some scenarios and some businesses that can take advantage of Azure. And I'm going to be interested in writing applications for that. Oslo, my jury's still out on that. I'm not really impressed by some of the demos that are showing, you know, a language that can be used to code generate data definition language for me, to generate a database schema for me. It just seems like that's a problem that's been solved over and over and over again. But I am kind of excited by the ability to use the pieces of that toolkit to build a DSL. I'm not really sure if that's going to be something that I do commonly, but I'm intrigued by the potential there at least.
Yeah, I guess Oslo seems like it's so far removed from the kind of apps that I'm building that it's hard for me to see a you know, how that fits in. Maybe in large enterprise apps where you're, you know, working in a, you know, I don't know. Just I don't see how I'd use that. Azure sounds interesting. I'd like to see more. It seems like so much of it is very abstract and requires completely new ways of thinking, which is, I guess, somewhat given from, you know, it's cloud computing and all that. But it'd be nice if there was a little bit more, like, you can connect to. From what I've read and looked at, it seems like data access is kind of more like you have these little blobs and you know, or there's SQL data services, but there's no. It just the whole data access story seems like it requires some big changes. And maybe that's just from my not, you know, knowing enough about it. I think one thing, too, is that I don't think that they demonstrated a huge compelling case for Azure at PDC. I just don't think that the story came off quite as well as was intended. I think that, you know, the idea of, okay, they're hosting all these services, they've got a huge, you know, as gosh, I forget his name, Ted Zwieba. He said, you know, he wrote this big post afterwards, and he said, you know, he's basically trashing on everybody as he does. And then he said, but in the end, who do you want to host your cloud services? Do you want, you know, a bookseller, do you want a search provider, or do you want Microsoft, who's been hosting services and, you know, writing web applications for a long time, you know, and, you know, from that point of view, it's like, well, that's compelling at least. I just thought that the story that was presented at PDC and just looking back, I think that Ray Ozzie and the group have just had a hard time with kind of selling what they're trying to sell.
You know, I kind of agree about the data access story. The one thing that kind of surprised me about the Azure stuff is that you know, Microsoft targets enterprises, and part of their goal is to kind of give enterprises a way to shift up to a more scalable, you know, sort of on-demand data center. But enterprises are building their applications against SQL Server. They're not building their applications against Azure data services. So this seems like there's a real disconnect in that story that I don't quite get. You know, maybe they're going to use linked entities to kind of provide some abstraction on top of that, or I don't know. But right now it seems like if you're going to write for Azure, you have to write for Azure. And they don't have that sort of growth story from the enterprise to the cloud. So that was a big, you know, sort of missing piece for me. You know, Oslo I find interesting because I kind of, now that I sort of started thinking about DSLs, you know, external DSLs, I kind of start seeing them everywhere. It's kind of, I'm finding this to be a weird mental shift for me. Like, so thinking, and a lot of it comes down to stuff people have expressed in the past in XML, but you want to do it without the angle bracket noise. I think you could do some cool things with Oslo, with the DSL portions of Oslo around that. So I don't know. I guess that's the more to be seen in 2009. But that's where I'm sort of seeing immediate applications for Oslo. I think the big Oslo picture is still very hazy in my mind. You know, where they're really going with it, with the model-driven development and all that stuff. And I don't think they've really communicated that all that clearly. But that piece of it has kind of grabbed my interest a little bit.
Yeah, I agree. I don't know what the big vision is for Oslo yet, but I am glad that what we saw at the PDC was a lot of text with curly braces. I think a lot of people, myself included, thought about Don Box's background, and we knew he was sort of behind this, and we were afraid that something was going to come out where he had to build everything using XAML or using some sort of visual designer that produced XAML. So it was nice to see a syntax that didn't involve XML. Who's with me?
Here, here.
Some of the things we were talking about, like link to entities, that all came out with the biggest service pack the world has ever seen, which was Visual Studio 2008 Service Pack 1. And I'm just trying to remember the slew of features that came out of that. There was ASP.NET Dynamic Data. There was the, for better or worse, the ADO.NET Entity Framework version 1. What else was in Service Pack 1? Was that when they shipped the official Silverlight 2 support?
No. Silverlight 2 wasn't released until later, September or so. But one thing they had was a lot more web developer support. So, like, for instance, better JavaScript, IntelliSense, support for classic ASP. I don't know, that sort of stuff. And then there were a lot of just performance improvements everywhere where they had you know, much better startup times and rendering in WPF and stuff. One other deal was the I think is cool. I don't know. I haven't seen people really using it all that much, but it's the WPF shaders. I think those are just really slick. I don't know exactly what I'd use them for, but I sure want to use them on something.
ADO.NET Data Services also, which I have mixed feelings about. That's sort of the link to REST story in a way. If you're using ADO.NET Data Services from Silverlight, you can basically produce a proxy that looks a lot like the object context in the entity framework and just fire link queries at it, and it translates expression trees into URLs to send to data services and bring back data in JSON or in Atom protocol. Has anyone been using that?
No,
not me.
Yeah, I've done a little bit of work with it, and the read story is fantastic. You can pull data. My two areas of concern are that updates are still a little bit of clunky. So anytime you want to push data back to the server, the API is sort of awkward. And also on the server side, there's not a lot of extensibility points. They have the concept of query interceptors, where you can add additional predicates to the query that's going to be executed on the server. But there's no real extensibility points. It's a very high abstraction layer over WCF. So I'm sort of interested in how the WCF REST story is going to play out.
Since you mentioned the REST thing, this seems to have been the year where REST really caught on in the .NET space. You know, I think other technologies, you know, sort of got REST before the .NET world, but the .NET community was still kind of stuck on SOAP for longer, I think, than some other people. But this year it seemed to kind of all click. You know, a lot of the Azure stuff is built on RESTful interfaces, and they, you know, like, as you say, the link to REST stuff and the WCF REST toolkit, which is in beta now, that was one big shift that I saw this last year, was that, you know, REST kind of gelled for the .NET community.
Yeah, I think Microsoft definitely saw that that was the way that so many of the big enterprises had to go just to be able to scale up their operations and to provide that simple API that you don't need a full toolkit with a full SOAP stack just to communicate with. All right, so the next topic is the biggest surprise of 2008, the biggest sort of bad surprise or disappointment was that the fact that the Seinfeld and Bill Gates commercials were pulled with just in a couple of weeks after they were released, was that that everyone was still using Twitter after the beginning of the year when everyone was swearing that they were going to move off of Twitter, and just the fact that microblogging is still centralized and hasn't become distributed at all. Is it that OpenID hasn't caught on still? Was it all the SQL injections and script injections that have been going on this year after all the hard work that's gone into security and educating people about how to prevent this sort of thing?
I guess I would have to say it really was I think the Seinfeld Gates thing was a bad surprise for me. I just felt like they totally lost their nerve with that. I could just picture a conference room where people were like, it's not working. And someone else being like, look, this is a long-term campaign. And I don't know. It's just, I think that they kind of blew that one. I would never see Apple doing that. You know, Apple like would just be, you know, like, look, this is our strategy. We're doing it, you know? and I think that this is the kind of thing. It's like, to me, it really felt like, you know, the scene in Napoleon Dynamite where he gets up and he just does his triumphal dance at the end of the movie. And it just seemed like, you know, Microsoft got up and started doing this dance and then kind of lost their nerve and wandered off the stage, and it totally ruined the moment. I don't know if that was me. I know a lot of other people hated him, but I just, you know, the idea was not to sell anything. It was just to you know, do this brand building stuff. And I don't know. My brother's in the ad industry, and he and his friends loved it. So somebody liked it.
You know, I didn't particularly like it or didn't particularly hate it. It did kind of make clear that Microsoft just has no ability to market themselves right now. They seem to be just stuck in this quagmire where they cannot put a good face forward on the marketing front. I don't know what it is exactly, but you think, you know, they have as much corporate resources as you could possibly have in this world and still can't put together a decent marketing campaign. So, you know, it is what it is. But yes, except for Oxite, which was really well marketed. unfortunately, the thing they were marketing was not particularly good. But anyway, yeah, I don't know. I don't know what Microsoft's going to do. Maybe Windows 7, which is getting tons of great sort of buzz, is going to sort of help them break through that. But they just have no marketing cachet whatsoever, as far as I'm concerned right now.
You know, you said a bad surprise with OpenID acceptance, but I really was happily surprised to see OpenID growing. If you go to myopenid.com, they have a blog and they show the acceptance. And I think that it is kind of a hard sell to get websites to accept someone else's login, and they don't control the membership database. And I think it's a confusing sell to users, but it is cool now that I can go to Stack Overflow and then I can jump over to User Voice, which is where they track their bugs and feature requests, and it's all inside of OpenID, and my login just flows across. It's just done. I don't have to log in twice or anything, and I don't have to set up an account or a password with either site. So you know, I mean, I think that it's growing. And regardless of if OpenID takes off, I think that people are it's starting the move towards people getting the idea of, I don't want every single website who's subject to SQL injection and losing their databases and getting hacked and all that. I don't want everybody to have my contact information and you know, my same password that I use everywhere or variations or whatever. It's just, I think we've got to get past that, and so I'm encouraged to see any progress there after none for a long time. People have been pushing, you know, different identity systems for a long time, and just nothing's happened. And this year, finally, it seems like something's happened.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, that the OpenID story has definitely been good and bad this year. good from the sense that, you know, a lot of the major players are now OpenID providers, which is just a big thing to happen. You know, Google and Microsoft and Yahoo. I think Yahoo's experience still sucks on that front. But, you know, that was a big first step to get all these people to support that. I still think that OpenID, the OpenID user experience sucks. I mean, I don't think it's a natural thing for people to have to enter these URLs that sort of represent their identity. I don't think people, you know, it just doesn't gel with how people are used to working on the web. So I think until they, clean up that experience, and, you know, I'm not an OpenID expert by any sense, but my interpretation of the direction Google was going and how they implemented OpenID actually did help that, you know, experience a lot. If sites can go down that road, I think OpenID will go a long way in the next couple of years.
Yeah, I do agree with you. The site that runs my OpenID, Janrain, which is a weird name for a company, they have a solution called RPX Now at rpxnow.com. They've got a login widget that is OpenID, but it makes it look a lot more friendly. That's what they're using over at User Voice, and I think it's a good system. But I agree, it's something where there's that finishing touch of, you know, actually making it appealing for users has not been taken care of.
All right, I wanted to look at good surprises this year. One thing that struck me over the last month is the success of the EPC. So these are the laptops that typically weigh less than 3 pounds, typically cost less than $500. Some people call them netbooks. I remember a time when Microsoft had this Project Origami and they were launching the ultra-mobile PC. And I don't know if these are really ultra-mobile PCs in the sense of what Origami envisioned them to be with the touchscreens and everything, but I've seen a lot of people lately blogging about picking up an EPC to travel with and even do presentations with, and I'm just kind of surprised that these things have suddenly actually taken off.
So first of all, do either of you guys have one?
No,
not yet, but I'm getting close to it.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. To me, it's all about the transition to everything really being online. I mean, 90% of what I do these days when I'm not in Visual Studio is in a browser. So once that transition happened, that you can make these really small, portable, basically web browsing terminals and really have them be useful.
Anyone have a Kindle?
Nope.
I've looked at a few that other people own, and they keep intriguing me. I think the price point is a little bit high. When they first came out, I thought they would be a total failure, but I still see people buying them. And I guess the one enticing thing now is just that so many magazines and newspapers are available and relatively affordable too, like a couple bucks a month. I just think that's actually, I like to read magazines, and that actually makes a much nicer experience on a Kindle as opposed to carrying the paper around and having to throw it away. So I'm kind of glad that the Kindle's still around. And apparently still sold out at Amazon.com at the moment. Although it's still, I think, near $400.
Yeah, to me, the Kindle has to drop in price, and the content has to drop in price. When I looked at it, I was sort of shocked at how small a discount you get for, you know, buying a totally electronic copy of the book. It doesn't really seem right. It seems like one of those it's inevitable things. One day we're all gonna have, you know, ebook readers and happy, happy, joy, joy, everything will be wonderful, but it still seems a few years out for like really, really mainstream acceptance.
Yeah, I think right now it's at the point where it's, you know, the price point's high, and it's a very nice to have if you've got the money for it, but it's kind of hard to justify if you it's there. All that stuff is still pretty expensive for what you're getting. So going to my price point, which is free, I've been pretty happily surprised by how Twitter has recovered this past year. I had kind of jumped over to friend feed for a while, it seemed like, you know, they were doing everything right compared to Twitter, and Twitter was just obnoxiously bad. And they really have been stable, and it seems like they've done a lot of the things that, you know, people have been telling them they needed to do for a long time. You know, they've offloaded their API to other servers at search.twitter.com. They've it looks like their Ajax implementation, you know, is doing the right things as far as offloading the work to the browser and allowing for caching and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, it really seems like they've gotten their crappy system to actually work. So that's been a good surprise.
All right, so what do you think was overhyped this year? I know two things come to mind when I think about overhyped. One is the Microsoft Surface, which is still obscenely expensive. And I can see it being in the lobby of a Vegas casino. I can see it being in specialized places like that. But I don't see all the hype behind trying to get regular developers interested in this thing that still costs about $10,000. And I can't imagine even 3 or 4 years from now this is going to come down in price to the point where it's going to be in everyone's home.
Yeah, and, you know, especially contrasting that with this stuff that I don't know if you've seen, like, Johnny Chung Lee has been doing stuff with Wii controllers, the Wii remotes, or Wiimotes, as the kids call them. And, you know, those just have the infrared sensors, and he's doing this really cool stuff where basically for $50, you know, and it's doing similar kinds of tracking, and it's multi-touch and all that. And so, I just can't help wondering if, yeah, $15,000 is just, it does make it a niche thing, and there's a limited amount of developers that are going to be working on those, and, you know, development shops that can afford one and that kind of thing. And so I'm hoping that they do make some kind of breakthrough where they switch to, they figure out something technology-wise that allows them to really simplify the technology and the cost of these things. Otherwise, it's a neat thing, and it's neat at a conference, but I do agree. I think from the point of view of how much they're pushing it to the huge, broad developer market, it doesn't, it seems way out of proportion.
Yeah, the Surface thing is weird to me because, you know, it's sort of conference wear. It's like something they break out of their development conferences and say, ooh, look how sort of cutting edge and cool we are. And, you know, they have these things all over the PDC, but, you know, whoop-de-doo, 99% of developers are never going to get to do anything with it. You know, and Surface was sort of a cutting-edge application of multi-touch when it was first announced. And, you know, you sort of contrast that with what, say, Apple has done, where they've actually taken multi-touch and made it useful to everybody. You know, they've got it on the iPhone. It works really well. They've got it on the trackpad, you know, the giant trackpads on the new Mac MacBooks, you know, support multi-touch in a really nice way. So, you know, whereas it's sort of stayed an interesting research project at Microsoft that's relatively useless. You know, Apple has done something really cool with it, and maybe the Android guys too have done too. I don't know. I haven't looked at Android, but so that's been kind of frustrating. And even with what I've seen of Windows 7, you know, it looks like Microsoft is going for the whole multi-touch on the screen, which to me is like not nearly as interesting, or not as interesting, isn't as really useful as the multi-touch on the trackpad, angle. So again, it's like almost trying to be cool for being cool's sake rather than make something that's really useful and broadly applicable and a lot of people can work with.
Cool. Anyone else have an opinion on overhyped?
Well, I mean, I guess going back, we already talked about it a little bit, but the cloud computing thing, as it's sold right now, is still a little too nebulous for the amount of push it's getting. I mean, it's basically all Ray Ozzie talks about, and you know, you hear about it at every conference, and yet there's no announced prices for Azure. And there's still some kind of things where, you know, like as an example, you know, kind of a public conversation about this this sort of thing lately has been with Stack Overflow, you know, and Jeff Atwood building up this small website, you know, running on the latest, you know, ASP.NET MVC and SQL Server and Link to SQL. And, you know, he seems like, it, you know, the target market kind of for this sort of thing. And I'm not, and as it's marketed right now, it's not the right kind of thing. And the best way to move forward for him at this point was to buy two new servers and, you know, become his own IT shop. And so anyhow, to me, that's just kind of highlighted that this, the cloud computing thing right now is kind of like at the high level architecture stage. And, you know, a lot of PowerPoints with clouds on them still, and it's still kind of filtering down to the point where actual developers and small shops are able to leverage it.
Yeah, the fact that Microsoft is not saying anything about pricing yet, it's just like a huge red flag to me. Like, who is going to spend a bunch of time building out a bunch of infrastructure on a platform for which they have no idea if they can actually afford it, especially since it requires all this special development stuff, you know, like it's not just SQL Server, which again would let, you know, if they did host just SQL Server, for example, then that would let Jeff, you know, sort of experiment with moving Stack Overflow up to the cloud, but that's not even an option for him. So, I mean, that combination of, you know, no migration path and no pricing, it just makes Azure sort of a non-starter to me for anything other than just playing.
True. So something else that's been kind of nagging at me this year has been all of the coverage of parallel computing and multi-threading. I think it's a very useful topic. I think it's a place we have to be. But it's almost as if every article says, well, in a couple years, the average desktop will have 64 cores, and your one program needs to take advantage of all 64 cores. And I keep thinking, I don't want every application that I'm running to be trying to use every CPU. I'm running more applications now than I did 2 years ago. So I have all sorts of things in the tray and all sorts of things in the background. And Outlook itself can take 64 cores, I think. Just starting it up takes about 71 threads last time I checked. So in a way, I think that's being overhyped a little bit. I think everyone's trying to find the right abstraction to try to hide multi-threading from developers. That's usually the only way that multi-threading really works, is that not have the average developer try to program and avoid race conditions. But at the same time, I don't think we really need to be encouraging people to try to take advantage of every last byte of RAM and every core that's running on a machine. But that's how I feel about the scenario.
Yeah, I'm just hoping that, you know, I'd like to see things move to using abstractions, you know, like the parallel link or whatever, and then hopefully that those abstractions will handle the threading in a smart way that's best for the user and not for the program. I think that, you know, obviously Outlook does not do a good job of keeping the user first. You know, it assumes it's the only program on the computer at times, you know, so I'm hopeful that we get to more declarative type of multi-threading and taking care of multiple cores and all that, and, you know, and then let the operating systems or the frameworks handle that. I mean, you definitely see the move. Like, I just bought a cheap $500 Media Center computer, and it was a quad core, and, you know, so I mean, you definitely do see the trend. It's you basically can't buy a single core laptop anymore. It's, I mean, I guess maybe a netbook, but, you know, everything's dual or more core for laptops, and then, you know, you're seeing quad cores become pretty common. And so, I mean, the trend is there. I don't know about 64 cores in a couple of years, but I'll let you make the crazy predictions, Case Scott, because you have the perfect track record.
Yeah, I'm really good with predictions. I was telling everyone before the show that back when Microsoft announced C#, I predicted it would be a failure. So that didn't really work out that way, but I'll try to avoid predictions now. Anyway, in the chat window, Kevin mentioned MapReduce. So that makes me think of a topic which got a lot of coverage this year, which I actually think was good, and that's functional programming. So we saw a lot of topics covering F-sharp and Link and even jQuery to some extent that talked about the advantages of functional programming. And I thought that was good. I don't think that's something that a lot of .NET developers who have only done .NET work have ever really been exposed to.
I have very little to say about functional programming because I have not done much. Okay, I've not done anything in All that right. space. It's one of those things where it's like I'm sure someday I need to learn this stuff, but right now I'm running to keep up with the stuff that is on my plate.
I guess the coolest thing I've seen with functional programming is the way that Microsoft's doing it. They're not making it an either or choice. It's kind of more of an and choice. Like you're able to use F-sharp from within a .NET application without shifting your architecture. So that's cool. And I like the way that Microsoft is pulling functional paradigms like Link into and other things with the expression trees, et cetera, into their mainstream statically compiled language. So I think that we're ending up with kind of the best of both worlds. And then it is cool seeing that F-sharp is moving towards, you know, being a mainstream language in Visual Studio 2010. So I think that's good. I really enjoyed our conversation with Matt Podwasaki this year. I thought that was kind of one of the more interesting and more of a stretch conversations for me. And, you know, before doing that, I spent, you know, a good day playing with the F-sharp interactive compiler, and then a good amount of time afterwards, and super interesting. It's just it's still like at this point it's hard for me to fit that into my day-to-day work, but maybe that's because I just need to get used to the paradigms. I'm not sure.
And then something else that seemed to get a lot of coverage this year was dependency injection and version of control containers and all the frameworks that just seem to come out from everywhere, from Microsoft and open source frameworks that do inversion of control. I think it's good that that's sort of getting into the lexicon of more developers to at least give it a try, don't you think?
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, this has been a big learning year for me, and you know, doing real work with the iContainers is one of my big new sort of areas of exploration. And I totally agree that it's like it's awesome that it's really has moved from a I don't want to say obscure because that's not the right word, but a less well-known sort of technique to a real sort of front and center technique and, you know, set of tools. And, you know, object relational mappers too, you know, with Link to SQL as sort of the, not necessarily the best one, but it's sort of a very visible one sort of toward the end of last year and then coming into this year and then, you know, pulling along with it in Hibernate and other object relational mappers. 3 years ago, you know, IOC and object relational mappers were not really something I was using, and now they are. So it's definitely been a big change.
Yeah, I guess I'd have to say it's positive, you know, to see that. And as Microsoft is working in those spaces, then they're when you're writing applications that are built expecting people are going to be using dependency injection or object relational mappers, you build more testable, I don't know, frameworks that fit into an ecosystem rather than assuming that they're, you know, the only thing that your developer cares about. So that's all good. There are some trade-offs to it. It's good, but then, like, for instance, finding any sample code. I recently was looking into the model view model pattern for Silverlight, and anything I found, you know, I had, here's my dependency injection framework, and here's how I'm doing this, and here's my other framework for this, and that's all fine. But then you end up with a, you know, you can't just learn one thing at a time. You've got to know all these other things, and you know, I've got to learn your dependency injection framework. And by the way, that's 200K, which has a negative impact on a Silverlight app. So I mean, there's trade-offs to it, but I think overall, it's definitely a positive direction for a lot of reasons.
Yeah, I was going to ask, are you trying out Prism on the Silverlight app or just using Unity?
You know, I looked at Unity 1.2 just shipped, and they have Unity 1.2 include Silverlight, but even that's 200K. And I know that doesn't sound like much, but like the Hard Rock Memorabilia app, the entire Zap is 69K. And, you know, the download speed is very important. People don't want to be downloading half a megabyte or a megabyte, you know, just to see something on a web page. So right now we're looking at doing, we have kind of our own small lightweight framework that we're using on my current app. And so for right now, we're not looking at using dependency injection. So I mean, these are kind of weird trade-offs that I don't think most developers run into, but it definitely is kind of a weird spot in Silverlight where you've got these kind of battling concerns. There's also the way that some of the threading and event model inside of Silverlight fights with some of these things too.
True. I only asked that because I started during the holiday break here, I started a little project using Prism, but I was targeting WPF, so the size really wasn't a concern. But I've really quite been enjoying it. And it was the first time I had used Unity, and that I didn't realize how big of a framework that was, but that is a tough trade-off in Silverlight. But the one thing I really do enjoy is the event aggregator in Prism. It solved a lot of those background threading problems. Maybe the ones you're running into. I basically have the view subscribed to events on a UI thread and services subscribed to events on a background thread. It just sort of magically takes care of all of that. And then through the container, I can inject different event aggregators so that when I'm running my unit test, everything just happens on the same thread. And then I don't have to worry about threading in the unit tests at all.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that this is kind of more of an edge case. You know, we're even, like, we're not using syndication feed to handle RSS and Atom subscriptions. We're not using Link, you know, we're just, because all those things add, you know, 100, 200K, and all those things are, you know, you don't even care about those running on the server or even a desktop app, but it does make a difference on download speed and loading speed and all that for a Silverlight app, which is, you know, enough for somebody to just say hell with it and close the browser. So,
right. Well, and you can certainly do dependency injection with a lot less than, what'd you say it was, 122 kilobytes?
I forget. I think it was closer to 200. You know, Allende wrote this thing. He wrote a blog post in how to do dependency injection in 15 lines of code. I think, Kevin, you pointed me at that article. And so, I mean, there's definitely, a place for something like that. You know, if somebody cranked out a, you know, here's a 10K dependency injection framework that's very simple. Or, you know, and I'm going to show my lack of understanding of the concepts probably, but I wish that there was a way that you could get those benefits during development, and then you can optimize them out when you compile. You know, so I can build with everything, and then, you know, as I have access to all my testing frameworks, and then when I compile, it says, it permanently injects those dependencies and says, here's your compiled down framework, and we can strip out all this stuff in the release version.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I do think John raises an interesting point, which is that in the .NET development world, we don't really think a lot about code size. I mean, the framework itself is, you know, has grown to epic proportions. It's however big it is, 100 megabytes or whatever, uncompressed. I personally don't optimize for assembly size or, you know, any of that. And now that we have Silverlight as a sort of first-class .NET development environment, we have to start thinking about that stuff again. I think we're just at the starting of that process, but it's kind of an interesting sort of mind shift to start making again. You know, we don't. I had sort of stopped thinking in terms of, like, how do you micro-optimize your assemblies so that, you know, you minimize the packaging size. But it's a real issue again, you know, in the Silverlight world. And, of course, it's been an issue in the web development world. Everybody, you know, minimizes their JavaScript and, you know, combines that stuff, but not so much for .NET developers.
All right, last topic on 2008. It's a question for John. What's the best new website in 2008?
Oh, that has to be, it's ICANN has, it's something about, there's these cats, and they say the funniest things.
ICANN has cheeseburger?
Right. No, but a close second would be Stack Overflow. Yeah. I've just, you know, I'm totally biased. I'm friends with Jeff, and I helped alpha test, you know, some really early builds of it and stuff, and you know, come up with some of the, you know, beginning list of tags that he was going to use and all that. But I just continue to go back out there, and when I've got questions, you know, sometimes I'll lob them out on Twitter and get some good feedback. But, you know, in the interest of just like, you know, number one, getting my questions solved, and then number two, getting them out there, you know, I don't have to go, oh, now I solved this problem, I should go blog it. I mean, it shows up in Google. So, I mean, I think that it's just a great way to share information, solve problems together and all that. So I think it's a notable thing that happened in 2008.
Yeah, it certainly got a lot of buzz. And I've gone there a few times. I just haven't spent a lot of time there, though. I think it's interesting that Microsoft seems to have rolled out a new version of their Forms software recently. And first of all, it's kind of flaky for me. It's like every other time I try to go to the MSDN forums, if I find something in a Google search and I click on it, the first time I go there will be an error page, and then I simply do a refresh and suddenly the topic appears. Does that happen for anyone else?
Yep.
Yeah, that's odd. Must be the entity framework.
As far as I'm concerned, the Microsoft forums, you know, all have uncategorically suck. I mean, the forums.asp.net is just the absolute worst like forum site ever. The social stuff is it's just not great forum software. I don't know what it is. Like, do they just not think it's important to invest in that? Do they just not have the resources for it? I don't know. But to me, that's one of the most important resources that they could put out there, and yet what they put out is total crap, and everybody is going to Stack Overflow instead. Totally frustrating as far as I'm concerned.
Well, yeah, I think that it feels like, because it is, it feels like it's an obligation, it's a cost center for Microsoft, and it's something that they know they should do and whatever, but it doesn't feel like Stack Overflow is Jeff's passion, right? And the guys on the team, like, they're excited about it, and they, you know, like, are up late at night and brainstorming on how they can make, you know, this communication site better. And from the you know, the Microsoft sites are a lot of time contracted to other companies and or built using software that Microsoft didn't write, and it just doesn't feel like it's something that they passionately care about, you know. And another thing is that these sites take some, like, not just moderators and people out answering questions, but they take some nurturing. And like I've seen with Stack Overflow, as they opened it up to more and more users, that the usage of the site changed, and they've continued to modify things and tweak things to continue to make it useful. And I think that takes an effort.
To me, those Microsoft sites feel like they're designed by a committee. So whereas Stack Overflow was Jeff and Joel, and it was Jeff's passion, and they were really trying to research this and build something that that they were going to like. It really feels like these MSDN forums are built by a committee that's just building up a feature list on a whiteboard and then trying to throw everything in. Then the other thing about Microsoft, of course, is they're obsessed with statistics, so they really want to determine how they can measure the success of a forum, and it's apparent that they do that by the number of answered questions, which I don't think really measures user satisfaction in the forums. I know someone had a blog post today, Colin Jack, about he asked a question on a WCF forum and someone gave him an answer and then marked their own post as an answer or something to that effect. So it sort of took control away from him as the person posing the question and never really determined if that answer was satisfactory or not. And I can tell you that I found the ASP.NET forums particularly painful, not in the design or the way they work, but just the quality of answers has just become infuriating to read, unfortunately. And I think a lot of that has to do with the way Microsoft measures success, which is how many questions have you answered. And so people just try to rack up points just by throwing up answers that are just hideous.
So going back to Stack Overflow, I mean, the thing that I like about it is just that, you know, it's not the source of all truth. You know, there's obviously going to be bad information out there, and there's people who are posting bad answers. But just having a place like that, having one place where you know you can go, and it's really simple to ask a question, and it's really simple to answer a question on whatever top programming topic you have. Like, that is immensely valuable to me, just having that place. You know, you don't have to figure out which news group to go to. You don't have to figure out which crazy Microsoft forum it, you know, they're using this week.
Of the 256 that are available.
You know, there's, it's one place, and you know it's got a really good community, and you know you've got a pretty good shot at getting your question answered. You know, that's awesome. And there, it was, you know, now that we have it, it's so obvious how much we needed it. You know, at the time, I wasn't really thinking of it as this like huge missing piece, but now I do.
Yeah, the whole question about, you know, like it being the source of all knowledge and, you know, that there could be wrong information, I think is kind of a weird problem that people have with it. Because what did we do before that? You know, you went out to these forums on Microsoft where, you know, like you were saying, Kay Scott, people would mark their own question as the accepted answer, or someone else would accept an answer, but who knows if it's right or not, you know, and then, and there's no easy way for me to say like, no, this isn't right. I mean, I can post something else farther down the thread, but, you know, or I can go out and look at a blog post that may be outdated or maybe written by somebody who really didn't know what they were doing. So, I mean, the thing I like about Stack Overflow is that people continually can vote up and down, and it's you know, there's, people have raised concerns about like, well, then it's, you're democratizing truth. But I really have found that the people that care enough to go and vote up and down are people that usually care about the answers and are going out and trying this stuff. I found a really high quality level. And, you know, people are going back to these questions and saying, you know, thanks, I tried this, it worked. Or adding comments saying, you know, well, thanks for this answer, but let me clarify my question. What I really need is this. And I've also seen, you know, like John Rezig out there answering JavaScript questions, or, you know, like, I don't know. I've gotten great answers back from, like, Silverlight's a pretty small community, and I'm seeing a lot of, you know, I'll lob something out there and I'll get answers from people that, you know, like are the who's who of the Silverlight world. So, I mean, and John Skeet is like just a machine out there. He's an authority on C sharp, and he's just, you know, just tearing up all these questions on C sharp. So, I mean, it's, I think that the quality has been pretty good.
All right. Enough about 2008. Let's try to look ahead. Some of the things coming up in 2009, I guess Windows 7 should be entering a beta pretty soon. Apparently it's already been leaked on the internet, but the beta should be out soon. And me personally, I've never been particularly excited by operating systems. Even Windows 95, I don't know. I don't get too excited over operating systems. But I guess the thing I'm really looking forward to is the DLR. I'm really hoping that ships next year. I hope Visual Studio 2010 ships next year, even though it's still 2009. But the DLR has been a long time coming. I think it's going to open up a lot of great possibilities, and getting languages like Python and Ruby into the .NET space is going to be fantastic. What are you guys looking forward to?
Yeah, I guess, you know, Windows 7, I'm looking forward to that, partly because I thought Richard Campbell summed this up really well, where he talked about that there's this continual cycle with Microsoft, and it's probably not intentional, but it's just what ends up happening, where they'll take these big step forward operating system releases that are, you know, conceptually daring but not polished. And then the next release after that is where it actually works, you know? So there was like, you know, I mean, he goes through the whole history, but there's like Windows 95 to Windows 98, and then there's, you know, 2000 and XP, and, you know, and Vista was a big step forward in a ton of different areas, but not polished. And then what it looks like Windows 7 is just polishing it up. It's a stabilization release for Vista. And if that's all it is, I'm happy with that. You know, it's, I'm looking forward to, I mean, there's a lot of good stuff in Vista, and it's just, it's not polished, and it's not, you know, this beautiful package that compares to what people are expecting now in an operating system. So I think that will be a really positive thing for anyone, you know, using any kind of Microsoft software. I think that's going to be the biggest thing in 2009.
Yeah, I agree about Windows 7. I'm definitely looking forward to it, just because, like you say, it's their chance to kind of, if you'll forgive my French, polish the turd that Vista is. I don't hate Vista, and it's fine for a lot of things, but I think there's a lot of cleanup that they need to do, and it looks like they're doing it. And, you know, the buzz that I've been hearing has been really good, so that makes me very hopeful. You know, people are running it on netbooks and saying it performs really well, which is a great sign, because Vista is definitely a pig. I think, Scott, I think you're right on with the DLR and the Visual Studio 2010 stuff. I think that's going to be really exciting stuff. You know, I'm looking forward to C# 4 and being able to do some cool metaprogramming magic in C# with the dynamic stuff. I'm not sure if Office 14 is coming out next year or the year after, but I think there's going to be some interesting stuff there. Microsoft is finally taking a stab at the web-hosted Office, basically. So, you know, I'm definitely interested to see what they're doing there. And then sort of fleshing out the Oslo vision, maybe interesting, maybe not, but at least kind of expanding on where they're going with it, I think is going to be an interesting thing to happen over 2009. Still seems like a much bigger vision than just, you know, 1 year's worth of software development, but sort of crystallizing what the vision is, I think will be interesting to see over the next year.
I think it's going to be interesting to see. There's this Pink, this Project Pink, which is supposed to be, you know, not putting Windows Mobile on a Zune, but kind of more pulling Zune into Windows Mobile, which is, I don't know, just kind of interesting. Windows Mobile is definitely, it's not impressive as a platform when you compare it with what other, you know.
Rap.
Right, yes. And there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot that is promising inside of Microsoft, and it's just Windows Mobile is not at the level that you'd expect it to be. And so it'll be interesting to see if they can to build a compelling consumer product and put that experience on Windows Mobile. And what I'm hoping is that they can do that without dumbing it down. It seems like in some places, like Xbox, I think they've done well. Zune is kind of hit and miss. When you look at what you get playing media on in the Windows world now, you've got Windows Media Center, you've got Zune, you've got Windows Media Player, probably a bunch of other things too. It's not a smooth experience. And then when you get into the Zune software, there's a lot of basic stuff like, you know, retagging or sorting. There's just a lot of basic things that you can't do that are really frustrating. I can't easily drop an MP3 onto my Zune. You know, I've got to install the Zune software. I've got to add it to. It's frustrating. So I'm hoping that they're able to, like, build a compelling user experience on mobile, and not make it stupid, not make it Fisher Price. And so anyhow, that Project Pink, people are speculating, supposed to be in 2009. We'll start seeing something come out there.
Well, I was going to say, when you talked about Windows 7 running on an EPC, I'd like to see Visual Studio running on an EPC too. Visual Studio 2010. I had really high hopes when Rico Mariani joined the Visual Studio team that it would become a lean, mean IDE again. I'm not so sure that's going to happen, but there are days when I get really frustrated with the performance of Visual Studio 2008. Even after I take out all the plugins like ReSharper and things like that, it still is just a pig.
Yeah, I totally agree. You know, with the first CTP of Oslo, Microsoft put out IntelliPad, which was they had been calling Emacs.net, which is supposed to be a different form of editor. I haven't been too impressed with that so far. Maybe I just am not getting it yet. And it's really, as far as I can tell, only useful for Oslo development. But there is some hope that maybe that will grow into being a effective, lightweight code editing environment. Because I agree, Visual Studio, I'm a little sick of the bloat in Visual Studio.
Then the other thing John brought up was kind of hinted at with some of the duplication inside Microsoft, or just duplication that surrounds Microsoft. So, you know, I don't know, on my PC I have a Zune, so I don't know if when I launch a video, is it going to play in Windows Media Player, is it going to play in the Zune software? I'm not sure what's going to happen, but I thought it was kind of interesting that the mini Microsoft blog, the guy hinted at some layoffs possibly coming, and then he sort of retracted that, I think, in a later blog. But there's definitely the sense that there might be some trimming at Microsoft. And someone else floated the statistic that the Zune team or division or brigade or whatever you might call it is around 800 people. And I thought, wow, that's a lot of people just for the Zune. So I'm just wondering if Microsoft itself might become a little leaner and meaner next year. Yeah, I think it was Brad Wilson where I first saw that statistic. And then when I went out on Google to look for it, it was actually in the mini Microsoft blog. Someone in there in a comment said that the Zune team was around 800, which is, I think, obscene. There was a time when in the Microsoft circles when there used to be the showdown inside of Microsoft, right? So there'd be two teams, they're both building something similar, and it's just a matter of who can produce the best solution and who gets to market first or something like that. And now it seems like you can have the case where we'll release two different object relational mappers. We'll release Link to SQL and we'll release Entity Framework. And yeah, we'll figure out later what to do with it. And we'll release the Zune player and the Windows Media Player. And, you know, we'll just confuse people in the marketplace. And I just think overall that ends up hurting Microsoft now. It's slowing them down quite a bit.
There's some frustrating unrounded corners too with Zune, especially when, you know, you're talking about 800 people working there. An example is my brother and I both have Zunes, and both of us have had the same experience where we thought, hey, I'll buy my brother some Zune points for his birthday. And you can't do it. They don't have an online way of buying points and sending them to someone else that has an account, which is ridiculous. Like, and so they've lost a couple of sales there, you know, in a kind of small ecosystem. And the solution is you have to go buy a card or order a card, you know, sent to you in the mail. Well, but they didn't get those sales. You know, I sent my brother an Amazon certificate or something. It just seems bizarre that, you know, after having been around for that long, that they still don't have that part of, you know, the whole buying software thing does not work smoothly in the Microsoft world. And I guess as you're talking, you know, sort of in the context of, you know, 2009, I mean, they just came out with store.microsoft.com, and we're starting to see a little bit more of like trying to fix this. But as it is right now, like, you know, on an iPhone or in the iTunes world, you know, it's very easy to buy things, you know, and that's good. It's good for the seller and it's good for the buyer. And in the Windows world, Rory Blythe had just a scathing post on this about how hard it is to buy Windows mobile software or to sell it. It's completely annoying. Whereas on the phone, on an iPhone, you click a few buttons and you've got a fart machine on your phone, you know, or a lightsaber. I think those are the two things that iPhones do. but you know, and so I think, you know, Zune is another example there where it's like, it's not smooth, in order to, you know, buy points and buy my brother a song and send it to him. It's like, they don't make that, it's not possible.
I think they've just become so big that almost everything has to be done with a design by committee now, and you have to rally troops and rally resources and win your way up the political ladder to get anything out. It's kind of unfortunate that I think it's really hard now for a small team in Microsoft to make an impact and just produce something clean and elegant that can get out and get through all the red tape and all the paperwork and all the people that want to put their stamp on it.
The folks in DevDiv seem to have a better time at that than some of the other product teams. You know, we talked about MVC as kind of the, you know, poster child of last year's stuff out of that department. But like, and one thing I'm really looking forward to next year is seeing where that goes. You know, I want to see MVC V2, and because obviously it's a great platform, but there's a lot of missing pieces. So I'm definitely looking forward to that being fleshed out. MEF is another team that seems to be being able to build something really interesting, and they seem to be taking over the world at this point. I mean, they've got their tentacles and all over the place. So at least in that division, under the guidance of Mr. Guthrie, they seem to be able to do some fun stuff still. But yeah, I agree. In a lot of other departments, it's just there's no vision. There's no overall sort of driving toward
inspiration.
User, nobody's thinking about like the holistic experience. It's all checklists and feature bags, basically, as I call them, where there's not like a really unified product vision.
Well, and as you're saying that about the Scott Guthrie and developer division, I mean, I really see a correlation between groups that are writing managed code and success and usable software. And like as I look at groups that are not writing, like if you look at Office and Internet Explorer and a lot of things you just look around at Microsoft, the teams that have adopted managed code seem to be making more progress and more agile, able to turn out software more rapidly. That's when, going back earlier as you were talking about Visual Studio 2010, and I'm excited about seeing it move to some managed code and WPF. I mean, I think that's a lot more likely to make Visual Studio performant than, the legacy InterDev COM code that it runs on now, which if you've ever tried to build an add-in or, really dig into the guts of Visual Studio automation, you just you feel for the guys that work on this because it's just ugly. And a fun exercise for our listeners is to start up Regmon and FileMon and then launch one of these old applications like Visual Studio, current versions of Visual Studio or Internet Explorer or Word or Outlook, and just watch what's going on and think about all the, millions of lines of code that they're executing as, all these COM lookups are done and stuff. So anyhow, I mean, that's my long rant, but I do see that teams that are really digging into managed code are more likely to move away from that and are able to ship code more on time and more rapidly and that kind of thing. I don't know how that fits into a prediction for 2009.
All right. Thanks for listening to Herding Code. We hope to see you again in 2009, where we will be back with more feature bags.